This is Earth Files, the award-winning news site with the latest updates in science, environment, and real X-Files. Podcasting in-depth reports beyond the 6 o'clock news by Emmy Award-winning journalist Linda Moulton Howe.
In Jim Marr's book, Psi Spies, in the chapter The Enigma Files on pages 257 to 258, he describes a confirmation supporting what Pat Price had remote viewed about underground bases on this Earth inhabited by non-humans. Quoting from page 257, Captain Frederick Skip Atwater, former operations and training officer for the Psi Spies Unit, declined to talk about the then Secret Army unit in 1994. But by February of 1998, after the government acknowledged the unit's existence, Captain Atwater spoke at the 7th Annual International UFO Congress in Nevada. Captain Atwater, who was awarded the Meritorious Service Medal for his work within the remote viewing unit, stunned his audience by announcing that a Psi Spies study had confirmed previous reports of 4 separate alien bases on this Earth. Captain Atwater said he became a training officer for the Psi Spies in the mid-1980s and was ordered to test the government-trained remote viewers by presenting them challenging targets. So during one formal but unofficial session, Captain Atwater sent unit members to look at the 4 alien bases described by Pat Price. To Captain Atwater's amazement, this remote viewing session, which utilized strict remote viewing protocols, confirmed Pat Price's accounts and even added more details about the bases and their operations. What was even more amazing to the attendees of this UFO conference, including Jim Marrs, who was in the audience, was that this incredible confirmation of alien bases on this Earth by a decorated military intelligence officer was neither covered nor reported by any news media. Unquote by Jim Marrs in Psi Spies. I asked Jim Marrs to explain more details about what the remote viewers found about non-human underground bases on Earth.
One of the best and earliest remote viewers was a former police detective named Pat Price, who just by happenstance they stumbled across and brought him into the testing that was being done at SRI. And he proved to be just a tremendous remote viewer. Well, Pat Price would not only do what they asked him to do, but he would take it upon himself to go look at things. And one day he showed up with a report he had written up about these 4 alien bases that he had seen on the Earth. One of them is in the Pyrenees Mountains between France and Spain. The other is in Zimbabwe in Africa. Another one is located under Mount Hayes in Alaska. And the 4th base was under Mount Zeal in Australia. As I recall, the one in the Pyrenees is a transportation hub. That's where they kind of come and go for off-planet.
Maintenance and repair base.
Yeah, that's the one in Zimbabwe in Africa. That's where they go for maintenance and repair. The one under Mount Hayes in Alaska is for monitoring the Earth, looking at weather patterns, pollution patterns, finding out what's happening with the Earth, and the one in Australia apparently is a rest and recreation area. That's where they all kind of mingle and kind of hang out. Apparently, they had come across several different species. Almost all of them, if they would talk about ETs, would talk about the diminutive grays. I think the lizards were also mentioned. I think they see all of these. On the 4 bases, the transportation center of the Pyrenees seems to be primarily under control of the little grays, but they see them working with each other at certain other bases.
You have interviewed Lynn Buchanan and Mr. McMonagall and Morehouse and Mel Riley, who have been very good at remote viewing. Has anybody talked to you privately about seeing specific details of non-humans?
Oh, yes. Yes. At one point, when they were discussing amongst themselves these occurrences of remote viewing UFOs, and they were discussing, well, you know, where they come from, what are they all about, they decided, well, why don't, instead of talking about these random sightings that we're seeing, why don't we just track it right back to the source, figure out where the control point is? They actually tasked Mel Riley to go take a look at what they could only describe as Intergalactic Federation headquarters, okay? And he ended up with a very, very bizarre experience. He ended up in a mountainous area with a very large plateau and a huge lake that he equated to something similar to Lake Titicaca, and that there was a huge ziggurat there, or pyramid, with a sloping ramp, which he ascended. And inside the pyramid was a huge room with a dais in the center of it, and that they were hooded figures standing around there, and that the prominent emotion he felt was happiness and joy at almost a homecoming. It was like he had been there before, and he went over and lay on the dais while a beam of light came down and enshrouded him, and he just said he had a complete feeling of well-being and being home, to the point to where he really didn't want to come back, but they ended the session and he came back to his 3D material existence.
But what did he see in terms of physical features of the hooded entities?
I don't believe he ever got any clear picture of who these people were. Now, keep in mind, the remote viewers, several of them, have told me that not only have they seen various extraterrestrials of various visage, as you pointed out, the grays, you got the reptilians, you've got the tall blonde Nordics, but they have also seen beings of energy and light, which they call transcendentals. So there is just a whole wide spectrum of life out there, and some of it is not even on the material plane of existence as we are.
But did Mel Riley come away with any sense of the agenda of these hooded figures, that the whole reason for the remote viewing was to go back to the source controlling the non-human interaction with the Earth?
Right. I think that this gets past the three-dimensional material plane and shows us that there are other planes of existence, and it gets into what I guess I could only call the spiritual, and that we are all beings of energy, and that as such we're all connected, and that when we come and are relegated to this 3D material plane of existence, we're all here kind of like going to kindergarten. We're here to learn some lessons, to learn how to get along in a material world, perhaps just to experience the material world, and that at some point we will again graduate and we will again become part of the energy whole of the universe, which is omniscient and omnipresent and pretty well fits the definition of God. They've had all kinds of strange and exotic experiences. That's why I say in my book, Sci-Spies, that if you get into this, your life will never be the same, because you will be so much expanded in consciousness. Mel Riley, for example, I'll never forget, told me, he said they really had problems with the Sci-Spy unit because, you know, they were tasked to go look at Russian submarines. And as Mel Riley said, he said, when you go out and look throughout the universe, you know, who wants to go look at a Russian submarine?
Well, whatever the agenda of the non-humans, I was very interested in the fact that the remote viewers, in some cases, extending themselves into things like what's happening to the ozone,
right,
have picked up what they would describe as futures of this planet, in which there is a collapse of the ozone that is serious between 2005 and 2012, leading to a very different surface life on the Earth. Could you talk about that in some detail?
Right. Some of the military-trained remote viewers were tasked to look into the future and find out what the future looked like, and what they saw were people living underground and people living in domed cities to protect themselves from a harsher environment, apparently due to increased solar activity and a continuing depletion of the ozone layer. Interestingly enough, they also saw in this grim future the fact that humans were working in conjunction with extraterrestrials. And they saw the sky was striated and was multi-hued, in other words, like there were chemicals in the air. And one of the things that made a very definite impression on me was that the sci-spies said when they look backwards in time, everything's pretty fixed and everything's pretty solid. You know, it's already happened. There it is. But when they look into the future, the farther into the future they try to look, the more blurry things become. And this is pretty interesting to me because this would seem to me to indicate that the future is not etched in stone and that the future is in a state of flux. And therefore, we still have the opportunity to change our future by changing our actions in the present.
It does not make sense that our government would not still have professional remote viewers working and in operation right now.
Absolutely. Let me tell you how this works. Right now, the government officially would tell you that they have no formal remote viewing group or organization within the government. And technically, that's probably true. But what they have done is, number one, they have taken individual remote viewers and embedded them within various groups and organizations. For example, I understand they have a remote viewer in the Navy SEALs. They have at least one remote viewer in the Army Rangers. And this only makes sense because what military commander would not want somebody near at hand who might at least possibly give him some indication on what's over the next hill? I also understand that there are remote viewers embedded in various other government organizations, and they also are contracting out to former SciSpies, many of whom are now teaching and have a cadre of students on hand, and they get a contract to go work a session, and then they get the raw data from their viewers, and then they feed the data back to their government sources. And in this way, the government has plausible deniability.
And I wondered if you could now explain what seems to me one of the most important parts of the entire history of SciSpies in your book, that Ingo Swann went out to Jupiter before we had been there with spacecraft. Could you summarize what he had seen in remote viewing, how far before our spacecraft were there?
Right. Well, in the early 70s, Ingo Swann remote viewed the planet Jupiter, and he wrote down, and it was filed and certified, that he said Jupiter has a small ring around it and that Jupiter has a weak but nevertheless present magnetic field, that there are cloud banks, and under the cloud banks he could see large craggy mountains. And of course, at that time, nobody had gotten a good look at Jupiter and nobody knew any of that, so it was just a great big huh from the science community. But almost 10 years later, when Voyager space probes went out there and began to transmit back data from Jupiter, it was reported in reliable scientific publications that they found it had a small ring around it. It had a present magnetic field. They could detect cloud banks and mountains under the clouds. So it took almost 10 years, but here came the feedback to show that Ingo Swann's remote viewing of Jupiter had been dead on. Another thing, the most astounding feedback that I mentioned, and it's there detailed in SciSpies, is that when the Mars Observer was lost, I immediately picked up the phone and called some of the remote viewers that I'd been dealing with, and I said, hey, what happened to the Mars Observer? And the Mars Observer had just gone into orbit around Mars, and they had high hopes that it was going to photograph and look closely at almost the entire surface of the planet. And then all of a sudden, it's just like they lost contact and it went away. I said, what happened? And they said, right off, the same thing that happened to the Phobos 2. Well, the Phobos 2, named for one of Mars's moon, was sent by the Soviets in the late 80s, and it too was lost as it went into orbit around Mars. And they had already checked that out, and what the remote viewers saw was that a circular object rose from the surface of Mars, came out to meet the Phobos 2, scanned it with some sort of electromagnetic energy, a beam, if you will. Now, none of this was hostile activity. It was described to me like kind of like the tugboat coming out to greet the Queen Mary. But once it scanned the Phobos 2, it realized this wasn't part of its system, so it turned the object turned around and went back to the surface of Mars. But in scanning the spacecraft, it scrambled the onboard computer, and controllers lost control over it, and eventually the spacecraft burned up in the atmosphere as it crashed. So there was a heck of a story. But then in the early 90s, a Soviet cosmonaut was visiting in the United States, and in a news conference in San Francisco, she held up one of the last photographs taken from the Phobos 2, and it showed a circular object approaching the craft. Again, amazing feedback for something the SciSpies had seen.
But Jim, wouldn't that imply that there is now current intelligence on Mars, underground, or someplace that is releasing probes?
Absolutely. And this leads further credence to the argument that, beginning with the face on Mars, the Cydonia region, that NASA has gone to extreme lengths to cover up this fact and to hide away and to alter photographs and to alter documents and everything else. The idea that they are keeping secrets about UFOs and about activity on Mars and perhaps the moon, that's been a long-standing narrative within the UFO research community, and this only tends to confirm that.
How have we managed, then, to get the mock camera and the spacecraft that are going around Mars currently in air, as well as Spirit and Opportunity rovers on the surface of Mars?
Well, could be that whoever's on Mars, now they know that we're sending things there, so they maybe they've dug deeper underground, or they don't come out as much, or whatever. Then, of course, again, we're back to the allegation that some of this information that they are getting is being sequestered and censored and kept from the public.
If Ingo Swann was able 10 years before we had a spacecraft to get to Jupiter and do a reality check, and it matches what he had remote viewed 10 years before, isn't that alone fact enough that remote viewing works so well that we should be using it generally?
Exactly. But again, they, the people in charge, don't want remote viewing used generally, because then we might see through all the lies and deceit that our modern society is built upon, and it could cause harm to the bottom corporate line. And as a result, I think there's been a concerted effort not only to denigrate remote viewing, but to actually sow dissension and keep the remote viewers themselves squabbling with each other and arguing over protocols and technology so that the public does not get a clear picture. What if the President of the United States was to come on television and tell us there are weapons of mass destruction in this country and we have to go bomb this country to save ourselves and to defend our national security? And then out here you had groups of remote viewers who'd been practicing and were pretty good, and they'd sit down, remote view, and then they'd stand up and say, no, there's nothing there, folks. Obviously, they can't have that.
In Jim Marr's new book, SciSpies, he writes about the United States Army's remote viewing Enigma files. Quote, late in 1988, Mel Riley, a remote viewer, was working on projects for the U.S. Army. He recalled that their superiors brought them a satellite photograph to study. The photograph showed simply a glowing object, but in remote viewing sessions, the object had humanoid people in it, and the craft was hovering above a nuclear storage facility. The remote viewer impression was that these visitors were bean counting, taking an inventory of the number of armed warheads at the military depot. When the SciSpies remote viewed and tracked these objects back to their point of origin, the remote viewers found the objects came from subsurface locations on our moon and Mars, and that they would come to rest in subsurface locations underground on Earth, unquote. While I was interviewing Jim Mars, I questioned whether the Voyager and Galileo probes had confirmed a hard core to Jupiter that might have mountains. On September 13, 2007, I called astronomer and Jupiter expert Professor William Hubbard at Arizona State University in Tucson. He confirmed that Jupiter does have a thick ring of silicate dust that comes off of its interior moons and surrounds Jupiter, that Jupiter does have a magnetic field, that there are many, many layers of cloud banks in Jupiter's atmosphere, each made from different chemicals. The highest cloud layers are made up from the lightest chemicals, and the denser chemicals make up the lower cloud banks. And to my surprise, I learned that Professor Hubbard and others have a paper ready to submit to a major science journal very soon for publication in 2007 that will focus on a growing astronomical controversy. Does Jupiter have a solid core? And if so, how large is it? Professor Hubbard said their paper will feature new computer models and data that indicate a likelihood that Jupiter does have a solid core that could be as large as 10 to 20 Earth masses. Would that core have mountains? Professor Hubbard said that currently there is no scientific instrument that could determine the physical nature of the suspected Jupiter core, but we could be headed toward scientific consensus that Jupiter does have a solid core. And that means Ingo Swann's remote viewing more than 30 years ago was nearly 100% correct.
Thanks for listening to this Earth Files podcast from the edges of science, environment, and real X-Files. Go to www.earthfiles.com to see more than 1,000 Earth Files reports with photographs, drawings, and documents. And visit Earth Files every day, every week, for new reports and new podcasts. That's www.earthfiles.com.